a lover and his lass, with a hey and a ho and a hey nonny no and a hey nonny nonny no, that o'er the green cornfields did pass in springtime, in springtime, in springtime, the only pretty ring time when birds do sing, hey ding-a-ding-a-ding, hey ding-a-ding-a-ding, hey ding-a-ding-a-ding, sweet lovers love the spring. The carol they began that hour with a hey and a ho and a hey nonny no and a hey nonny nonny no. How that a life was but a flower in springtime, in springtime, in springtime, the only pretty ring time when birds do sing, hey ding a ding a ding, hey ding a ding a ding, hey ding a ding a ding, sweet lovers love the spring. Then pretty lovers take the time with a hey and a ho and a hey nonny no and a hey nonny nonny no. For love is crowned with the prime in springtime, in springtime, in springtime, the only pretty ring time when birds do sing, hey ding-a-ding-a-ding, hey ding-a-ding-a-ding, hey ding-a-ding-a-ding, sweet lovers love the spring.
Good morning. Welcome to East Shore Unitarian Universalist Church. I'm Julia Katowski, a member of the Board of Trustees. You are welcome here. No matter your age, your size, the color of your eyes, your hair, your skin, you're welcome here. No matter whom you love or how you speak or whatever your abilities, you are welcome here. Whether you come with laughter in your heart or tears, you are welcome here. If you come here with an open mind and a loving heart and willing hands, you are welcome here. If this is your first time attending, we hope you will join us for coffee hour following the service. If you are new to Unitarian Universalist faith, you can speak to any one of our members, and we also have pamphlets in the narthex.
Please rise now in body or in spirit and open your gray hymnal to number 188. This is a song that was set to music by Lynn Unger, a Unitarian Universalist minister, and it was adapted from a poem by Rumi, the 13th century Muslim mystic. But she left one line out of the poem, and the poem goes like this. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, it's a really hopeful and generous reminder that we all break our vows now and then, and over the course of a lifetime, thousands of times, and yet we can still come together again. So let's begin by saying that line together 3 times, okay? Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, and then we'll start singing. Though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, though we've broken our vows 1,000 times, though we've broken our vows 1,000 times.
Whoever you are. caravan of despair. Come, yet again come.
So tonight, in most of the world, Ramadan begins. And Ramadan is the holiest month of the year in the Islamic calendar, as Muslims believe that during this month, God revealed the first verses of the Quran. During the entire month of Ramadan, Muslims fast from dawn to sunset. Now, Ramadan, especially the fasting part of it, is about self-discipline and making room for God to come into your life. It's about making the effort to see things differently without the distractions of food and alcohol and even sex. It's a month of celebration, reflection, repentance, and sacrifice.
We light this chalice in celebration of the life we share in community. We light this chalice as we reflect on the impact we have on one another and our community. We light this chalice as an act of repentance for the mistakes that we've made. And we light this chalice as a symbol of the small sacrifices we make to bless the world.
So this is the first Sunday of the month. So not only do we have the children in the sanctuary with us for the first few minutes, we also collect food. And since this is an odd-numbered month, this month it goes to the Salvation Army in Painesville. So if you remembered to bring food, you can bring it up to one of the wagons, or you can hold it up for one of the kids to bring up. And if you didn't remember to bring food, that's okay, because good old greenbacks work really fine, too. And as that gets collected, let's sing number 1010, We Give Thanks. You notice a little cartoon on the cover of the order of service? For those of you whose arms might not be long enough to read it, the woman is saying to this very bedraggled man who looks like he's just come home from work, "You come home to find me eating beans from a giant can. How do you think my day went?" I think that's hilarious. I cut this out I found it on the internet months ago and printed it and put it onto my fridge. And every time I see it, I still laugh. I'll be driving down the road with my dear husband and I'll start chuckling and he'll say, "You're thinking about that cartoon, aren't you?" I don't know why I find this so funny, but to me, this is hilarious. Right, and that's the thing about jokes, isn't it? Like, jokes are very, very personal. What somebody finds absolutely hilarious just completely falls flat for other people. Or in my case, what you love and think is really hilarious falls completely flat with absolutely everyone. Jokes are so personal to people and to situations that it makes me think of when I was a hospice and chaplain. When I was a chaplain in hospice. And every day I would start my day by, this is back in the days of voicemail before everything went to text messages. I would have to spend an hour in a voicemail system listening to the information of all the people who had died in the night. That was a really tough job. It's a tough way to start your day, day after day after day. And so people in a situation like that, it's kind of like being at war. They end up developing this humor, this really sort of bleak humor that's called gallows humor. And I got to tell you, people who work in hospice are the finest, most wonderful people on earth. Huge hearts, giving, generous. Just ask Christine Berkowitz. She can tell you. But man, if you heard the jokes they tell in private, you'd think, what horrible people. It's really something. You know, and for me, humor is very much in the moment. I find I'm not funny at all if I've planned in advance what I'm going to say. But if I'm more sort of loose and limber and in the moment, I can actually get some laughs once in a while. But the problem with not having a script for what I'm going to say is that things have a lot more likelihood of not coming out the way I intended them to come out. That happened to me on Easter Sunday. So at the offering, I had this funny little gray egg that was inside of a piece of gray foam rubber with some flowers painted on it. And it was a gift from a friend of mine who was a Christian minister. And I felt like there was a joke in there that I wasn't getting. Because I just, honestly, I was taking it really seriously. I was kind of offended by the idea of this gray egg that's supposed to represent Easter. And Halcyon was kind enough to point out to me on Easter Sunday that, in fact, it wasn't an egg, it was a cave. Right? And the egg, it wasn't an egg, it was the stone being rolled away from the cave where Jesus' body had been interred. Well, I felt like a fool. Like, how did I not get that joke? Right? And so all of my Christian friends who all received these things at the same time, they all got it. And I didn't get it. I didn't get it until we were here in the service that morning. So I felt kind of silly. I felt kind of foolish. And Mary Bender, bless her soul, came to me afterward and said, you know, I'm really glad that there were no Christian visitors today. And she said, you know, I know you well enough to know that you didn't mean it, but I can see where somebody Christian would have felt like you were laughing at their faith. And of course, that wasn't my intention at all, right? So I thanked Mary because I felt like it was a really generous thing that she did to come to me directly and point that out to me. And it gave me the chance to come to you and say, I hope you understand where my intention was with that. I was not mocking Christianity, not mocking Easter. I mean, we were celebrating Easter. It just, there was this very kind of sweet, funny joke that I just wasn't getting. So it was a reminder that everybody interprets humor differently. And we can't possibly know how everybody is going to react every single time. And sometimes we make mistakes with our humor and we have to apologize the way I am now. So I'm sorry that I didn't choose my words more carefully that Sunday. And I wanted to make sure that I apologize, not just in front of the adults, but also in front of the children, because everybody was in the room that day. So, with that, let's sing the children to their classes with number 413, Go Now in Peace. As you came in this morning, you had a chance to take a stone from the bowl at the top of the aisle. right behind Don Adamson. And if you didn't get a chance to take one as you came in, feel free to get up and take one now. Or maybe you brought a stone from somewhere else. Maybe you have a stone in your pocket that you've been carrying with you all week. Well, I'd like to invite everybody to just take a hold of your stone now as we feel their temperature and their texture. And take a moment to just pay attention to our breathing as we share our joys and our cares and the other milestones of our lives that are written in this book. Doris Wintz is in assisted living at Holly Hill on Fairmount Road in Newberry, and she is doing better. Mary Bender wants us to know that there's a pair of eastern bluebirds raising young in the box closest to the playground. That's worth going to look at. And Pam Leininger and Barbara Opie arrived safely in Portugal, where they're going to be vacationing together for 2 whole weeks. I don't know about you, but I'm really envious. For these joys and cares, and in solidarity with everyone across the globe who is celebrating or suffering on this day, we observe a moment of silent meditation. I'd like to invite you now to place your stone in the bowl on the altar under our beacon. Or maybe you'll want to hold on to it until next week and carry it with you. This is a prayer written by Megan Lloyd Joyner in memory of a dear friend. Today I am thinking of how preciously fragile and how fragilely precious life is, and how we, even those of us who know this from experience, walk down the street on a summer day with birds and bright green leaves against the sky, like it is not a miracle. That our feet stick to the earth and our lungs draw air in, and we are all spinning in space, and that we got to be here in this moment, laughing or walking the dog or holding a child's hand or eating an ice cream cone. Amen. Please remain seated and join me in singing number 352, Find a Stillness.
So, I grew up in the 1950s with a mom and a dad. My dad worked full-time for the illuminating company as a lineman when I was a kid, and it was really physically hard work. He was a big guy, 6 feet 3 inches, well over 200 pounds, and he had big, strong hands and a deep, deep voice. My mom was a mighty mite, 5 feet 1 1/2 inch. Don't forget the half. Dad hogged the bathroom because he only had one. Because he was a man and he went to work and he earned the money that paid for our clothes and our house and our food. So, oh shoot, lost my place. Hang on, we'll get there. Sorry. Okay, he hogged the bathroom and the food, and because he went to work and he earned the money that paid for our clothes and our house and the food we ate. We often missed the bus because Dad operated on Dad time with no recognition of our school schedule. He needed the bathroom. We had to wait. One time I walked my brothers to the elementary school, 5 1/2 miles away, and then I walked another mile to the high school for me in the snow. I know it sounds ridiculous, and I made it up, but I didn't. I got detention for being late to school. At mealtimes, we did what we did back then, and I but everybody else did too, or a lot of people. They had got the choice cuts of meat and the largest helping of potatoes and the second piece of chocolate cake, if there was a second piece. That was our normal, and I thought it was normal for everyone. Dad worked really hard for us so we could eat. So Dad got the biggest and the best of everything, food, clothes, car, even the use of the bathroom. He got preference. He was entitled to it. I learned about noblesse oblige, and I thought maybe that was it, but it isn't. That's when you're really rich and you share with the less fortunate. That wasn't what we had. Ours was more like, to the mighty go the spoils. Dad was privileged. He earned. He was big. He was the man. So he got. On the other side, of course, was the rest of the family. Mom, four kids, me and my three brothers. In order for Dad to get, we had to give. It was a closed system. Only so much money for clothes, and he had to have work clothes and boots, and he was a big guy, so they all were special order. Only so many slices of cake and pie, only so many scoops of ice cream. Boy, was that a big one. He got it, but it's a closed system, so if he got the biggest and the best and the most, then we got the smallest and the least. There was no more forthcoming, so we had to make do with what was left. And we acquiesced in this. We expected it. This was our world. In order for Dad to get, we gave. The other side of entitlement is generosity, accommodation. It's generosity if it's given freely. But if entitlement is just taken or just assumed, then the other side is deprivation. It's sacrifice. In a closed system, there's only so much to go around. In a closed system, if you get more, then I get less. If you expect more and you get it, that's because I acquiesce. I agree to accept less so that you can have more. But we don't live in a closed system. There's always more, more, more in our world. At least we think it. I think we've forgotten our manners. Now people take a big piece because there are more big pieces somewhere out there. So I can have the big one and you can go find your own. When the four kids in my family grew up and got jobs and were still living at home, the kids started wanting preferential treatment, too. They're working. They're bringing home money. Can we give everyone preferential treatment? What would that look like? Everyone got the plum job, the biggest steak, the nicest house? Nope, not possible. Someone will always have to settle. Someone will always have to take the smaller portion. If they do it in gratitude and love, all is good. If they are forced to take the leavings, there's our source of discontent, I think, and war and strife. So here in the United States, we've been the big earner for two centuries. The world was happy to let us have the largest share because we provided so much for so many in the world who could not do it for themselves. But now in our third 100 years, the other countries are weary of giving to us. Just like my brothers and my mom, they want their fair share. And as a society, maybe we're not used to sharing anymore.
Thank you.
trenches and fields are clothed in green as the early leaf. The clouds above will water them with morning rain so sweet. The life of man is but a span, he's not done like the grass, but here's to the green leaf of the tree as long as life shall last. The moon shines bright, the stars give a light, a little before the day. We call once more unto your house, all in this month of May. My song is done, I must be gone, no longer can I stay. God bless you all, both great and small, and send you a joyful May.
I have two readings by Abu Hamid Muhammad ibn Muhammad al-Ghazali, who lived from 1058 to 1111, and is known in the West simply as al-Ghazali, thank goodness. He's of Persian origin, and he was one of the most prominent and influential philosophers, theologians, jurists, and mystics of Sunni Islam. The first parable, a man said to Junaid, "True companions are scarce in these times. Where am I to find a companion in God?" Junaid replied, "If you want a companion to provide for you and to bear your burden, such are few and far between." He paused. "However, if you want a companion in God, whose burden you will carry and whose pain you will bear, then I have a multitude I can introduce you to." And the second, a man of piety was following Christ. A thief, seeing this, thought to himself, "If I sit in the company of the pious one, perhaps God, for his sake, may forgive me." Prompted by humility in his heart, the thief started condemning himself for the impious life he had led. He considered himself unfit to sit by the side of such a saint. On the other hand, the pious man, seeing the thief seated by his side, reprimanded the thief, lest his shadow corrupt him. Immediately, Christ heard the divine voice say, "Tell the pious one and the thief that I have washed clean the scrolls of both. The virtues of the pious and the sins of the thief are washed clean. Now they must start life again. The virtues of the pious are washed away because of his pride, and the sins of the thief are washed away because of his humility and repentance."
Yesterday, I had the opportunity to do a eulogy for our late member, Marilyn Barber, who died in October. She was an artist, a person for whom beauty and aesthetics were very, very important. She appreciated people with style and taste, even as she recognized that style and taste are very personal, and that tastes, even good taste, very widely. So I talked very briefly yesterday about the artwork here on the three panels behind me and how even though she loved the process of how we made the artwork, she didn't, at least in that first year, really love the outcome. And Marilyn was proof that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Of course, we all know that, but there's a real tangible example of it, an example of how complicated it can also be. You can love one part of something and not so much another part of it. And beauty isn't the only thing that's experienced differently from person to person. Just look at humor. Have you ever yucked it up in front of a whole group of people only to find yourself a couple of weeks later having to go back to them with your hat in your hand and apologize to them? I have. And it got me thinking in the last couple weeks about the other things that get interpreted differently and by different standards. And generosity was one of those things that came immediately to mind. There's a story in my family that is a favorite, and if I've told you already, please forgive me and bear with me. When I was 13, my parents built a new house, and it was a really big deal. We moved from a little tiny single-story house with one bathroom and eight people into, yeah, I see Dee's jaw drop. My mother's sister and my father's cousin lived with us. So we were four adults and four children in a house with one bathroom. And my brother and my father's cousin and I slept in the basement. And so after the two older people flew the coop and it was just the six of us in the nuclear family, they built this new house that had five bedrooms and three bathrooms. It was a big deal, but it was three times the size of that first house. So there was a lot of empty space in that house. We're finally getting space where we could spread out a little bit instead of being crammed together all the time. And my mother couldn't wait to get furniture into this new house. They spent a lot of time designing it, picking all the finishes and the wallpaper and the carpeting and everything about it. And she had this vision of how perfectly tied together this whole place was going to be. And she knew it would take time, but she was really, really looking forward to that process of selecting everything and having it slowly grow to become something that she thought of as perfect. And that house would be her artwork, her manifestation of her sense of beauty. Now, at the same time, my grandparents were in the process of downsizing, right? They were empty nesters. They were in this huge house where they raised their family with eight children. They were ready to move to something much, much smaller. So on Easter weekend, right after we moved into that big empty house, my grandparents arrived in their boat of a 1970 Chrysler Newport. And they called us out to help them unpack, and we're like, it's a suitcase, what's the big deal? And my grandfather opens the trunk, and inside of it are eight dining room chairs. I know, right? That car was big. And in the back seat was his dining table. So we all helped them bring it into the house, and my mother watched this happening as my brothers and my father and I carried tables and chairs in and set them up in the dining room. And my mother had this big, fake smile plastered on her face as she watched this happen. I could tell that she hated it. I mean, she really hated it, but she never would have said anything that would hurt her parents. And we had a lovely Easter, a really good meal. It was all the usual. I mean, who doesn't like having their grandparents around, right? And when they left, you could see on my grandfather's face the sense of pride he had, having given something to my mother that was so valuable to him, something that they had worked so hard to acquire decades earlier. And they weren't even out of the driveway when my mother just lost it. Have you ever seen your mother bawling because she felt like she'd been waiting for years to go to the prom and her father was making her wear his best pair of floor-shine wingtips with her yellow taffeta dress? I have. I felt completely helpless. And my mother kept that furniture for nearly 20 years, not only in that house, but in the next one as well. So now it's 40 years later, and my mother has her dream dining table. with the sideboard and the hutch and the whole nine yards. And it's exactly the size and the style and the shape that she wanted. And she has a completely different approach with her children and her grandchildren. She won't give anybody anything, not even the tiniest little thing, without asking first if they would like it. She knows from experience that what is a gift of generosity and love, a family heirloom, a keepsake to one person, is a big mahogany burden to another. Generosity, like beauty and humor, can also be in the eye of the beholder or the recipient. My ex, who was a professional organizer, now that's an organizer of space and stuff, not people and movements. He told his clients all the time about things that they felt burdened by, that it was a gift, not a life sentence. He encouraged his clients to think about the meaning of the gifts they'd been given, to take pictures of them if that helped, to save the photographs instead of the actual gift, rather than holding on to something that felt like a burden. Gifts, he kept reminding them, gain power the more they get given away and passed along. And gifts are tricky, aren't they? I mean, think about Ricky's mother, who wanted her children to give their father the gift of the first choice in everything. And it really is a lovely lesson for children to be mindful of the work and the sacrifices of others so that they can live in safety and comfort and abundance. My mother and my mother-in-law raised their kids in the same way. Both my father and Joe's father, like Ricky's father, they worked hard. They worked in physical jobs outdoors. And they came home tired and hungry in a way that I have rarely experienced in my life. And whenever the weather was lousy and my siblings and I had the nerve to complain about it, my mother would stop whatever she was doing and she would stare at us. Imagine how your father feels having to work in that. Like Ricky, as a child, sometimes I felt oppressed by that. But for me, the value of the experience came from really reflecting on it later on. Because something outside of my control forced me to see the situation from a perspective of the other person. In the first Al-Ghazali story we heard, when Junaid was asked where to find a companion who shared his faith and his values, what he called a friend in God, Junaid told him not to look for someone to fill his needs. Junaid told him instead to find someone whose needs he could fill. In other words, you'll find more friends if you seek to be helpful rather than if you seek to gain an advantage. It's kind of a harsh dichotomy, if you ask me. Junaid's directive feels like it kind of assumes bad intentions and leaves out a simple reality. If everyone wants to help and nobody wants to be helped, then there's not much helping going on, is there? This is the kind of story that, taken to an extreme, makes asking for help feel almost shameful. This is the kind of story that sometimes makes me feel like I have to wait for someone to offer help, as if they can read my mind. Like I'm expected to drop subtle hints with the expectation that passive requests will actually work out in the end. Now, if you know me, you know that's not quite my style. If I need something from you, I just ask. And me, trying to be that passive would be like wearing wingtips with a prom dress. It might get laughs, but ultimately it doesn't really work. But the thief and the pauper both having their karmic slates wiped clean, that's a whole different thing. It's kind of terrifying in a way, the thought that all the good that you've done in your life can disappear because of one poor intention. But it's also kind of liberating to think about. I mean, obviously you can't unring a bell. So everything you do becomes everything that you are. And that doesn't disappear because someone, even someone as powerful as God, chooses to ignore it. But how liberating is it to think that someone could look at you completely anew? That someone who has known you all along, and not just your outward appearances, but your motivations and your fears and your longings, could just hit the reset button. It's often said that the job of the press and the job of the church is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I've never taken that expression to mean that we're to literally hurt people who have become complacent. I've always understood it to mean that our job is to help people open their eyes to realities that are too uncomfortable to see. Realities that, if we are as pious as we think we are, could change our understanding if we choose to see them. The job of the church is to get us to change our perspectives by reflecting on our lives. And not just our own lives, but the effect that our lives have on others. And that's what all these stories this morning teach us. Waiting for your father to come out of the bathroom before you head off to school, accepting a gift that you really didn't want, and having your scoreboard reset to zero, even though you've done everything right and earned lots of brownie points. These are all opportunities to see your situation from a different perspective, to see the beauty in a way you may not have been able to see it before. The lesson here is that we have to take time to reflect on our lives, our relationships, our experiences, our expectations. If we don't reflect on the differences, how differently we see beauty and humor and generosity, we stand the chance of falling into lifelong patterns of behavior that never get questioned, no matter how ineffective they may be. If we don't take the time to ask questions and reflect, our entire lives can get filled with the kind of tasks that serve no real purpose. Like the family for generations always cut the end off the ham before cooking it, only to learn that their great-great-grandmother did that only because her roasting pan was too small. If we don't take the time to reflect and ask questions of each other, we end up with traditions that say men always get the first offerings just because of their gender, and not because it's a choice made by their families to honor their work. There's a big difference there. And the hard part about that kind of reflection is that it requires taking risks. It requires asking before doing. It requires thinking before speaking. It requires questioning assumptions and apologizing when necessary, all with the understanding that we interpret beauty and humor and generosity differently. In other words, reflection is an exercise in developing humility. And that's the beauty in it. Because nothing is more beautiful than humility. I'd like to invite you now to rise in body or in spirit and open your gray hymnal to number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth.
Oh.
There's one act of generosity around here that never, ever, ever gets misinterpreted. And that's generosity of finances, generosity of resources. No matter how much you give, it has value. For some people, $5 is nothing. For some people, $1,000 is nothing. And for some people, $5 is a lot. And it's all good. It's all valuable. It's all appreciated. So with that, this morning, we accept your gifts offered in generosity for the work of this church. And if you're visiting for the first time, please let the collection basket pass you as our gift. Thank you for being here.
Your Board of Trustees, thank you for all that you do for East Shore Unitarian Universalist Church. Your contributions of your presence and time are greatly appreciated. Also, thank you for your financial support, which is also so important to keeping this community thriving.
For all who see a God that goes by many names, may God go with you. For all who embrace life, may life return your affection. For all who seek a right path, may a way be found and the courage to take it step by step.
Before we end with our bond of union, I have a few quick announcements. On Wednesday evening, there's a finance committee meeting at 6. On Thursday, the last of the four-part Queer Eye for the Bible class, this one being held at First Congregational in Painesville at 7. Friday evening at 5, Halcyon will be leading the creative execution of the fourth iteration of the art on the three panels behind the pulpit. Materials and dinner supplied. You don't need any particular skill in art to participate. Saturday morning, Seth Bryant will be back to lead a conversation on safety and security, specifically the recommendations made by the board charged committee. That's at 9:30 Saturday morning. We'll have coffee, fruit, and bagels. Next Sunday is Mother's Day and the Flower Communion, so please remember to bring flowers to share. After coffee today, there's a Joint Committee on Ministry and Religious Education Council meeting in Rev. Denny's office. And at 2:30, a meeting of our Sisters Keepers is being held at the Muslim Association in Richmond.
We should probably also mention that there's a blood drive going on, if you haven't noticed. And I meant to ask Bob before we came in here if you need to have an appointment or if you can still give blood even though you didn't make an appointment. Because I know there was still quite a bit of space left on. So does anybody know?
Yes, you can do a walk-in.
Excellent. Great. So I really want to encourage you, if you can give blood, to do that. Bond
cool.
of union?
Yeah.
Okay. Please rise now for the bond of union. If you don't know the words, they're printed in your order of service. We join hands in Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, pledging ourselves to an individual religious freedom which transcends all creeds, not to think alike, but to journey together.